ran into a storm, and it ran into a fever struck the Spaniards. Most of them died, and they were in trouble, but they're making their way to Lima. And Delano spends 9 hours on board the ship, and as I mentioned, most of the time alone, and he begins to become obsessed with the relationship between the white Spanish captain, Benito Sereno, and his black body servant, the man introduced him, that the Spaniard introduced as more as Babo. And he watches the way that the slave tends to Benito Sereno, holds him up as he kind of falls down, wipes spittle from his mouth, relations of affection. Delano at one point wants to speak to Benito Sereno by themselves so he could talk about compensation for the aid that he's providing the Spanish ship. And Sereno says, anything that you have to say in front of me, you could say in front of Babo. He's the captain of the slaves. And this goes on for hours. And finally, Delano leaves the ship, and he gets down in his boat, and he's about to row back to his ship, and Benito Sereno pitches himself off of the ship down into the boat, lands at Amasa Delano's feet. Behind him was Babo with a knife, a dagger. And it's at that point in the Melville story that the reader realizes that the slaves were in charge, that everything that they had been reading earlier, all of this strange story, and Melville tells it in this totally gothic manner, was actually organized by the slaves, that they had risen up, seized the ship, and were just pretending to be slaves.
Hold that thought.
Okay.
Because I want
that's the cliffhanger. The cliffhanger.
Okay.
That's <We've> good. As we continue our conversation with Greg Grandin, author of The Empire of Necessity, we want to invite you to join and become a member here of this KBOO community radio station. Our numbers are 877-500-5266. And if you call and pledge, we have a special thank you gift, a autographed copy of The Empire of Necessity.
This is a rich book. You do want this, not only if you like a good story, but especially if you want to understand a little bit more about the historic, the economic, the spiritual, the political underpinnings of New World and New World capitalism. This story encompasses it all, but you can't get it unless you make the call. And the call, well, you can do that two ways. You can do it electronically if you are streaming More Talk Radio anywhere in the world. That would be at www.kboo.fm. However, if you like low tech, if you like human communication, or if the phone just happens to be handier, you can do so by dialing 877-500-5266.
Thank you, Celeste. I didn't hear you sneak in. Or I didn't see you sneak in, rather. I've been so busy paying attention to this story that I forgot about pitching. I'm really riveted. We were having a conversation yesterday morning, the pledge drive team, about Herman Melville, and the story did not come up. So this is a new one to me. And it's true that Greg Grandin does have a large stack of books in the studio that he is furiously signing as he is telling us about his book. So if you would like to, we know you appreciate this, you're listening right now, and if you want to have that book and have more about this story right in your hot little hands while supporting our hot little station, you can call right now, 877-500-5266, or you can go online, make a secure donation at kboo.fm. But you must call right now to get that book, to get that autographed book, and to stay engaged with this show right now.
Good morning, Ren. Good morning, Cecil. Good morning, Mr. Grandin. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I would like to thank you, dear listener, for joining the KBOO experiment, this ongoing 46 years and counting experiment in community-funded media. That's media that does not kowtow to advertisers because the advertisers aren't involved. However, you, dear listener, are involved. You're listening, you are engaged, and now it's time to engage with your heart and with your dollars. 877-500-5266. And I would say when you call 877-500-5266, and you can put down $60 or more to keep KABU going so that there is a space on the dial for this sort of information and for these sort of authors to tell their truth and to tell the truths that they have found in the world, all around the world. 877-500-5266. Let us welcome you into the KABU family. And you can do that online as well, KBOO.FM. How you do it isn't nearly as important as the fact that you do it. KABU can do what it does because you do what you do, which is to keep, which is to help us pay the bills that we incur by bringing you all this stuff that you just cannot get elsewhere.
And speaking of doing it, Barbara and Donna did it. They are both two new members from here from Portland.
Thank you.
They get the cowbell salute. And they, what did they do? They called 877-500-5266. This ain't hard. You can do it too. Do it right now.
877-500-5266. That is the magical that's magical digital code that will put you in contact with my friends. Who do we have here? We have Davis, we have Mo, and we have my other friend whose name I forgot at the moment, but I'm sure she'll remind me shortly. And maybe I'm looking at you, dear listener, who's got $120. You can get the book and your very own KABU cowbell. How about that? You can't beat it. 877-500-5266. And that is just the icing, my friends, because the cake is another year of keeping KABU not only solvent, but thriving to expand and keep bringing you everything you need to be a fully engaged and citizen and a more fully rounded human being. We've got arts and culture programming, we've got the news and public affairs, and we've got this kind of authorship, this kind of research, this kind of engagement in the issues that still resonate to this day over the centuries and that are still important, and you appreciate that. You need it. You rely on it, and that is why you are going to go to your phone right now, and you are going to call 877-500-5266, and you are going to make that move from passive listener to active member. This is a membership organization, and it survives on the goodwill and the support of its members. KBOO.FM is how you get started, or by phone at 877-500-5266.
That's right, 877-500-5266. And now we're going to go back to Greg Grandin and his book.
Thank you so much, and we thank those of you who are becoming members or renewing your membership here at KBOO.
And we know you will enjoy the book. So we're talking now about Amasa Delano and how he recognizes quite dramatically that things are not as they seem. But there's kind of like a dual story. Well, actually, it's about four stories at least. And that's what he does once he realizes that the slaves have actually been in revolt. But then also, there's the story of his brother that kind of mixes in there as well. Can you tell us just a little bit without being in, and I know you mentioned spoilers, and again, the story is so rich in terms of narrative that there's no such thing as a spoiler. If anything, I'll call these more tidbits. These are like a moosh-boosh, you know, something flavorful for the mouth to get you tempted to read the book. But to talk a little bit about what his reaction is, because it's his reaction and the time in our country's development that really changed the course.
Yeah, well, when we last left Amasa a second ago, he was at the bottom of his boat with Benito Sereno jumping in. That was, I was narrating the Melville story more than the actual story. I was just talking a little bit about how it was that I came. Now, the Melville story is fantastic. It's filled with this gothic atmospherics, and I was preparing to teach the class, and I had no idea that it was based on a true story. And I was reading a footnote in another book of a book of literary criticism that had to do with Herbert Melville. And it was a footnote that said, Herman Melville's based his Benito Sereno on a true story, on the memoirs of the real Amasa Delano. And I remember staring at that footnote for quite a while. It was like reading a footnote that said Ridley Scott's Alien was a true story. Mm. Because it was so out of... I mean, it was a how could this possibly be true? How could these group of West Africans overcome the dire straits they were in? Two of them had died of dehydration. Two children had died. They were hungry. They were starving. They were desperate. And yet somehow they managed to summon up the inner resources to pretend to be slaves again for 9 hours and convince Amasa Delano, who turns out to be an ancestor of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that that all on board was a little distressed. There was some things going on, but more or less it was a normally functioning slave ship. So I thought that would be a good opening to explore the history itself. And yes, the real Amasa Delano, once he and now to say that Melville based the story on a true story, you know, Moby Dick's a true story, but Moby Dick was based as much on Milton and King Lear, say, as it was on the actual sinking, stoving of the whale ship Essex. Herman Melville pretty much comes close to plagiarizing chapter 18 of Amasa Delano's 1817 memoir. It's written very closely, except he does a very interesting change at the end, which we could talk about. But Amasa Delano, yes, he... once he realizes that he has been deceived, that the scales had fell from his eyes and he saw the Negroes for what they are, and that's a phrase from the actual Melville story, he rallies his men to put down the rebellion. And his men do it in an awfully god-awful, vicious, and brutal way. They use the sealing lances to disembowel and flail some of the rebels. They're all captured. The ship is secured. It's towed back to Talcahuano, a port city in southern Chile. A number of the rebels were executed in the pacification of the uprising. Others were put on trial in Concepcion and hung. Some were sent into exile in southern Chile. But the bulk of the rebels was sent onward to Lima to be sold. That was their destiny to begin with, and that's what happened to them. And one of the tensions of the story is Amasa Delano, who sees himself as a new man of the American Revolution. He is against slavery, he's against piracy, he believes in the world of law. This is the real Amasa Delano I'm talking about now, the historic one. He, if you read his memoirs, he believes that the American Revolution ushered in a world of transparency, in which man could perfect themselves, in which man could both govern themselves emotionally and govern themselves politically, and that the world was knowable. And yet, as he goes out in the world, that belief and hope is constantly proved false, and this incident is just one example of that. But this reformer, this modern man, this man who as a principle is against slavery, winds up suppressing the revolt and spending 8 or 9 months trying to extract half the value of the surviving slaves for compensation for putting down the rebellion.
So is this... Does Delano is a symbol of the struggle within the American soul of a desire for freedom as the American Revolution envisioned itself, but also wrestling with slavery itself?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's important to distinguish between Melville's rendition of Delano and the historical Delano. Melville turns Delano into... Melville leaves out all of the back history. Benito Sereno takes place on one ship in the course of a day. It's compressed in time and place, and it's claustrophobic. And Melville, in some ways, is the first fully formed American idiot abroad, or American innocent abroad, bumbling through the world, wreaking havoc, leading himself and others to disaster, the quiet American in Vietnam, what have you. And it's a powerful portrait. It's a little simplified and one-dimensional. I still think it's powerful, and there's a lot you can read into it. The historical Delano, in many ways, is much more complicated. You see how he's formed by the hopes of the American Revolution. He comes out of a community that early gives up kind of Calvinist gloom of predestination. He embraces a vision that the world is perfectible. He has deep faith. The American Revolution itself catapults him into the world history. It turns him into a cosmopolitan. And he's He's kind of like a Republican zealot. He shows up at the French Revolution. He shows up at the beginnings of apartheid in South Africa, the beginnings of British colonialism in India. And he's on the Galapagos before Darwin is. He sees all of these things that we associate with the beginnings of modern time, but he can't quite get a handle on it. And I think his reaction, though it obviously should be condemned and as hypocrisy, but I think it's also important to know the origins of that hypocrisy, how it plays out and what the drivers of it is, of it all.
Part of the hypocrisy of the American enterprise itself, but we are not hypocritical here. We want you to become a member.
We are sincere and authentic.
Most of the time.
And we strive.
Become a member here of KBOO, 877-500-5266, or on the web, kboo.fm. And if you become a member, call or via the web, you may get a copy of Greg Grandin's autographed copy of The Empire of Necessity. And we have some friends helping us this morning, so I'm going to allow them to share a little bit more information.
Thank you, Cecil. Good morning, everyone. My name is Sam. I'm here with Ren, and we are reminding you that KBOO is a membership organization, and when you call 877-500-5266, you will be on your way to becoming a member of KBOO, a part owner, if you will, of your very own, your community's electronic media outlet. And that is a very different model from most broadcast outlets. They're going to pay their bills by selling your ears to advertisers. And the programming there is just a way to get you to stay tuned in long enough to be exposed to capitalist propaganda. But we believe listeners can govern themselves and will do the right thing by supporting the electronic media outlet that supports them with all the news and information and arts and culture and music programming that's there to bring them arts and culture, music, news, and public affairs, not to deliver them to advertisers who clamoring to sell them a bunch of crap that they don't need or want. And we don't even send you a bill. We're relying on you, dear listener, to call 877-500-5266 and tell us the amount of your radio bill and to pay it just because it's the right thing to do.
I'm just loving this episode of More Talk Radio this morning. Greg Grandin's telling us this. We're talking about spoilers. This is compelling. I don't care if I know what the ending is or not. I want to read this book, definitely. And you too can read this book, The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World, with a $60 minimum pledge. Greg's got a stack of really lovely hardcover books over there in Studio 2. He's been signing them while he's talking. He's a multitasker. And he's talking about the actual story that inspired one of Herman Melville's books, Benito Cereno, talking about a witness to a ship, a slave ship that had been taken over by slaves who, as he said, summoned up the resources to pretend to be slaves again. Delano said, believed that the world is knowable, the world is perfectible, and that is exactly how we feel here at KBOO. Call 877-500-5266. Because you agree that the world is a knowable place, that we can make it better together, and that by looking at the history of where we've been, to understand where we are now, to see the overlap between the past and the present, to see how important it is for people to stand up when they see something wrong, when they see injustice, no matter what year it is, no matter where they are in the world. And that's part of what Celeste and Cecil do for all of us here each week with their show, More Talk Radio. They are bringing us those underrepresented point of views, and you will support that when you call 877-500-5266. And if you don't want to disrupt your listening experience right now, you can just jump online and make a secure donation at kboo.fm. But if you call right now, with a $60 pledge, when you call right now with that $60 pledge, you can get a copy of Greg's book, which he has autographed right here in the studio, 877-500-5266.
And you will be, as Ren said, you will be supporting that kind of dedication to the facts, that kind of dedication to accuracy, that sort of dedication to the proper information, the proper context that is so sorely lacking elsewhere, and you value that, and you rely on it, and that's why you will call 877-500-5266. Let us enter your name into the Good Book of KBOO. Join the KBOO family, KBOO.FM. This has been going, I call this an ongoing experiment in community-funded media, and that's exactly what it is. And we want to keep this experiment going. And speaking of experiments, you already know what it sounds like when you listen without contributing. So let's apply some science. We have the control. Now it's time for the test group. Find out what it's like to listen as an active supporter. Join in with Neville right here in Portland, who renewed his membership. Welcome back, Neville. Join in with Ed, who renewed his membership right here in Portland. And we're about to go back to a little bit more of what we're asking you to support here. So do that right thing. Make that call, 877-500-5266.
Thank you so much, Sam. Yes. And Ren.
Thank you.
And we're continuing our conversation with Greg Grandin.
So we were talking a little bit about the fact that even though this is based, or rather the story was based on both memoirs and a bit of Melville's work, that you still took truth and melded it with a lot of work. Now, I understood from doing a little research that you did some traveling yourself to do research on this. In the process of traveling, what did you find that really caught you off guard about kind of the backstory of Masa Delano and his, well, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but just the backstory of Masa Delano and his brother?
Well, Masa Delano, as I mentioned, was a sealer, and his brother was a sealer. And actually, if you read his memoir, it's a fascinating book, even beyond Chapter 18, because you do get the sense of a person coming of age during the American Revolution and trying to make good on the promise of the American Revolution, but it always slipping out of his grasp. He never quite being able to realize it. They did have one successful venture, and that was sealing during the 1790s. As I mentioned earlier, sealing was the first boom and bust resource extraction activity that the U.S. experienced outside of its borders. It was in the 1790s, sealers left New England, left Boston and other ports in New England, and headed around the Cape and into the South Pacific, and there was one island after another were just filled with seal rookeries. And they just had perfected a technique to separate the soft, downy underfur from the coarse hair of a fur seal, and started bringing them to China, Canton, where they traded them for ceramics and for tea and for porcelain. And in the 1790s, there were hundreds of thousands, millions of seals. Masa Delano himself took out hundreds of thousands of skins off of islands off the in southern Chile, brought them into Canton. He made quite a bit of money. This was in the 1790s. When he went back with his brother, they had such a successful voyage, they decided to build a second ship, and they headed out again in 1803. When they headed out in 1803, the nature of the trade, the nature of industry, had radically changed. What happened was that there were so many sealskins going into Canton that the market couldn't absorb them. The prices started to plummet. Sealskins were rotting on the docks in Canton. They couldn't fit into the warehouse. And this led sealers in New Zealand and Tasmania and Australia and off the coast of Chile in the Pacific to accelerate the killing of seals. So what you had happened was in a remarkably short period of time, the price of sealskin collapsing and extinction accelerating. And one island after another, rookeries completely disappeared. Now, that had the effect of changing the nature of the industry. During the earlier period, that earlier voyage where Delano did well, there was a lot of cooperation among captains and their crew. When the seals disappeared, it almost immediately led to an all and nothing system of labor relations and pitted desperate captains against desperate sealers. There were no seals to kill and no money to be made. Amasa Delano quickly learned this out when he was in Tasmania, and his men jumped ship because they had enough. They had been sealing for years and there was no seals to be. And Delano had to bring on board a bunch of convicts, escaped convicts from Botany Bay, from the British penal colonies there that had escaped. On his way back to Chile, these men were conspiring, they were grousing, they were making plans to mutiny. Delano himself had to rely more and more on physical punishments in order to maintain his authority, until he crossed paths with the Spanish slave ship, the Trial. And after the deception, which is its own story and fascinating story, but once the deception is revealed and he moves to put down and pacify the slave ship, that pacification had the effect of uniting his fraying authority over men that were increasingly not respecting it. So what I was trying to do with that is show the intersection of slavery and other forms of economic activity, in this particular case, collapsing resources, Amasa Delano caught in a vortex of supply and demand, trying to maintain hierarchical discipline over men in a crisis of scarcity, and how race and race terror and race violence allows him to reestablish his authority over his own men. So think of the contrast between Ahab and Amasa. Ahab rallies his men to hunt down a metaphysical white whale. What Amasa does is he rallies his men to put down real black-skinned rebels. So it's an interesting contrast in the way that this kind of sea violence and destruction that we associated with Melville, these two different faces of American empire.
As we look at these faces of American empire, this takes place in the beginning of the 19th century, and what I think you also examine a bit more is the relationship between the slave trade, and the development of capitalism. At that point in time, I'll let you tell the story.
Sure. Okay. So what we think of the explosion of slavery in the United States, we think of something that happened after the War of 1812, the invention of the cotton gin, the push into the West, the expansion of plantations into the Mississippi, into the Louisiana lowlands. That really was just the last gasp of an explosion of chattel slavery that started in the 1770s in the Caribbean, moved down to Brazil, into South America, and then to the United States. Obviously, slavery existed in the New World since the 1500s, but it was it was horrible and brutal, but it really explodes into the monstrosity we associated with the expansion of the Atlantic market economy with capitalism, and slaves were key to that expansion. In the case of Spanish America, they were fairly clear with what they were doing. They began to deregulate and privatize the mercantile restrictions which tried to govern slavery. By that I meant only a certain amount of slaves were allowed to be brought in, only in certain ports, Havana, Cartagena, a few other ports. Only a few companies or countries had the monopoly and were allowed to do that. But starting in the 1770s, the Spanish crown begins to words that we would use today, deregulation and privatize. They wouldn't use those words then, but that's what they were doing. And a phrase that they did use, which actually will sound very modern, is that they said that they wanted free trade in blacks. And it's pretty frank and
which
pretty
is
clear.
And ironic.
Right. It just always reminds me of, whenever I hear that, it reminds me of, and during a debate, Al Sharpton said, it was a debate over free trade, and Al Sharpton made a great comment. It was when he was one of his runs for president, and he said, my ancestors came over here in a free trade policy, so don't talk to me about free trade.
Well, one thing that's really important is, again, with this being in the early 19th century, we're talking about the 1800s. So given our historic placement on that spectrum there of slavery, Folks, especially in the northern part of the United States, might have had reason to think that slavery, for all practical purposes, was over. Not because they could look forward, but, you know, just thinking that the times were changing because of the industrialization and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's great with the story, because Amasadello leaves in that last voyage. She leaves in 1803, and slavery was, for all intents and purposes, over in the North. I mean, slavery existed in some pockets, but it was on the way out, and wasn't just perceived to be on the way out. It was on the way out in the North. A lot of people also thought it was on the way out in the South in 1803, that it was an institution that would just recede and wither on the vine. Obviously, that's not what happened. But what Delano sailing into the Pacific in 1803, in some ways, he's sailing into the United States' future. Mm-hmm. And then what the story allows me to do, then you have Melville reading about it 50 years later. It's almost a full circle, Delano's experiences with getting caught up in this event, which in some ways foreshadows what happens in the United States, and then Melville reading about it when the thing that was being foreshadowed is now a monstrosity and actually existing, the antebellum slavery and the crisis that was gripping. So it's a nice, there's a bit of a circular narrative to it, the book.
We're speaking with Greg Grandin, author of The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. So also there are other things happening in the world at the time of this incident. There's the revolt in Haiti. And so I think one thing that might be helpful, if you would share something about what else is happening in the New World. Some people, and I think you go in, you destroy the image that those who were brought over were passive and not able to resist.
Well, actually, they were sophisticated and looking for Haiti. They had heard of it.
Yeah. So talk about that. What's going on at that time, and in terms of slave revolts?
Well, the broader context before I get to the slave revolts is that this event happens at the apex of what historians call the Age of Liberty or the Age of Revolution. It's mm-hmm. a century after the American Revolution, a century before Spanish Americans begin to break away from Spain, and it happens in the year that Haiti declares itself independent after more than a decade long struggle against France, up and down struggle against France. It's really a remarkable moment. And yes, one of the things, after they seize the trial, after the West Africans seize the trial in the Pacific from Benito Cedeño, one of the things that they ask, they say, we want to be taken to a land of blacks that we hear exists in these waters. Benito Cedeño's first response is, no such land exists. I mean, I don't know if they were referencing Haiti, but I imagine that that's probably what they were referencing. They were referencing Haiti, and that Benito Cedeño immediately denies its existence. You know, there's anthropologists and historians who have talked about the denial of the importance of Haiti. That, you know, when historians talked about the Age of Revolution, they mm-hmm. talked about France, the United States, the Spanish America, but they left Haiti out. It's not till the last 10 years that historians have been incorporating Haiti, not just as another revolution, but the revolution, because it challenged the notion of property rights. But it's a wonderful example of that denial, where Benito Cedeño said no such land exists, and then they say, okay, then take us back to Senegal. Haiti, revolts were happening all over the place, and some of the rebels on the trial that staged a deception had been involved in two other failed rebellions even before they got to the Pacific, because the way they got into the Americas was in many different ships and many different ways. There's a whole chapter devoted to a slave revolt that has nothing directly related to this, except that it was successful. When historians talk about slave ship revolts, and when they talk about successful slave ship revolts, they're either talking about a slave ship that could be, you know, sailed, run aground, and the slaves jump off and they run into land, mm-hmm. or they establish a couple of weeks of freedom before they're captured or before they die. There's one slave ship revolt which I talk about here, the San Juan Nepomuceno, which left Montevideo on the way to Lima around Cape Horn in 1800. They rose up right before they got to Cape Horn. They seized the ship, and they demanded that the crew take them to Senegal. They got into three pitched battles with Portuguese and Spanish ships, but they made it to Senegal. They reversed the Middle Passage. I don't know of any other slave ship revolt where all of the studies that I read by historians working on slave ship revolts, it's remarkable. Mm-hmm. They reversed the Middle Passage across the Atlantic. Months. It took them months. It's just and the why it's related to this story, other than the fact that it happened in Montevideo, is that they were the slaves on that ship were Muslim, and the slaves on the trial that pulled off the deception were Muslim. And after both of those revolts, the viceroy of Peru wrote a letter back to Spain and says, we've got to stop taking Muslims as slaves because they come to the Americas with all of these perverse ideas.
When we come back, I want you to expand on that point, and also about the confluence of Roman Catholicism, liberal Protestantism, and Islam. But we want you to give us a call here at 877-500-5266 or kboo.fm.
Yes, we want to talk about the confluence of support, interest, and community. How can you do that, and what do I mean? Well, community, of course, are all of us who are listening and finding ways to share our efforts toward building a common vision of togetherness, of sustainability, of livability. Okay, what is the interest? The interest is not only interest that is the result of our attention being captivated by something that is sufficient, more than sufficient, to engage our minds, but it's also the interest that comes when you invest. Okay, and what is the investment? Well, that's your time and your money in becoming a member here of KBOO, a sustaining member. Where are my colleagues here?
We're right here.
All righty. So there's phone numbers. And you could talk about our business partners too, and how they have stepped on board.
Today we are business partnerless. But thank you, Celeste. Thank you, Cecil, and thank you very much, historian Greg Granton, who is in their studio with them right now, talking about his new book. You can support all of this right now by calling 877-500-5266. But today our food partners, our food partner was Jean, who brought coffee cake in, and we are not violating FCC regulations by saying that was awesome. Thank you, Jean. We appreciate it. And that was Jean's contribution to KBOO this morning, bringing cake, answering the phones.
Thank you,
and
Jean.
Helping us welcome new members to the fold and renew members to the fold. And what did those people do? They called 877-500-5266, or they went online to kboo.fm. When you call right now, and now is the time, you can get a copy for a $60 minimum pledge. You can get a copy of Greg Grandin's book, The Empire of Necessity. He's got a stack of hardbacks in there. I am absolutely riveted by this interview, talking about resource extraction in the 19th century and the hidden costs of it, the social injustice that comes from that kind of resource extraction. And we still have this right now. This is still relevant. We are reporting on it. KBOO reports on it every single day with our public affairs programming. There are hidden costs that we need to know the full extent of all the decisions we make in the world. And because you are listening, you care. You care. You want to be a part of making this world a better place, and you can make the world a better place by calling right now and supporting what we do, 877-500-5266.
That's right. I will say, I will specify that we means you, dear listener, and KBOO working together to keep KBOO alive and thriving. That's the important part. KBOO will be here. We will carry on, and we can do so with your support, and KBOO can improve and expand with your support.
We will do so.
877-500-5266. We're about to go back to some more of what we're asking you to support, so make that call right now. 877-500-5266.
Thank you so much, and thank all of you for calling. We're continuing our conversation with Greg Grandin, author of The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. Let me remind you that he'll be speaking at Lewis and Clark this evening at 5 p.m. And Before we continue with my questions, we have a caller who has a question or a comment. Good morning, caller. Thank you for waiting. And our engineer is distracted at this moment. And we'll go to our caller.
Checking Facebook.
There we go. Good morning, caller. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, George. We can, George.
Oh, okay, yeah. Hey, Greg, I'm about halfway through your book, and I'm really enjoying it. And the Melville's Benito Sereno is one of my all-time favorite stories. I would like to read the third paragraph in the book. It's a very short paragraph, but it almost capsulizes the entire story.
The paragraph from Melville, from Benito Sereno.
Yeah, from Melville. And I want to emphasize the word gray and shadows. It is sort of shades of gray in the shadow of slavery. But this is the third paragraph.
Grades of slavery. Mm-hmm.
The morning was one peculiar to the coast. Everything was mute and calm. Everything gray. The sea, though, undulated into long fields of swells, seemed fixed and was sleek at the surface, like wave lead that has cooled and set in the smelter's mold. The sky seemed gray, overcoat. Flights of troubled gray fowl, kith and kim, with flights of troubled gray vapors among which they were mixed, skimmed low and fitfully over the waters, as swallows over meadows before storms. Shadows prevent foreshadowing deeper shadows to come. I mean, can this guy write or what?
Yeah, it's a great passage, and it really does set up the... There's this kind of stasis to the story. I mean, if you read Moby Dick and Benito Sereno in tandem, they almost are mirror images, one in terms of form and style, where Moby Dick is sprawling and spilling out all over the world. Benito Sereno is claustrophobic, and I think that passage that you read, maybe right before it, he talks about the sea was like molten lead, but frozen though, but hardened, we're not moving, and I think, you know, that Benito Sereno definitely. Nothing really happens in the story until the deception is revealed. Yeah. Everything happens in Amasid.
How the slaves successfully learned another language.
Well,
and
I think
were able to pull the wool over Delano's eyes.
Well, I think they knew the language, but probably because they were from the coast. They probably had some experience with maritime trade. They probably knew some Portuguese and Spanish. They might.
There were universal languages along the coast, trade languages too.
And they were, and it's, it seems fairly clear that the leaders were Muslim and educated, and the historical documents indicate they knew how to read and write in their own language. And there was even an episode where they forced. This is the historical act, not Melville's interpretation now, got Benito Sereno to sign a contract promising them he'd return them to Senegal and they would return the ship to him. So they had a sense of contractual law and what that meant, which indicates a degree of sophistication that they probably didn't come from rural communities that inland communities in West Africa.
Well, they had abilities way beyond with the white stuff they were capable of.
Yes, that's the that's the point.
Part of a much older civilization, yes.
Well, that's my comment. And anyway, I'm certainly enjoying your book.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, George, for your call.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
And, you know, as we said, a lot of scholarship went into this book. And one of the reasons I want to try to take another element out and discuss it is the way it seems that... it expresses, as Cecil pointed out, a duality, not only in terms of the American conscience, but the way economy and the way politics developed in this country. You talked about the kind of person that Amasa Delano was, and that he came from a kind of a liberal perspective. He was the early Republican, so he had a different attitude. He kind of a live and let live attitude. But when he came back kind of penniless and didn't make very much money, he, as you said, his attitude kind of changed. And we've talked about the fact that he is a forebearer of of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Amasa Delano had a brother, Samuel Delano. Can you kind of compare and contrast the two of them as they're kind of like icons or emblems?
They represent, so Amasa Delano on that second trip, as I mentioned, they built a second ship, and because the first skinning voyage was so successful, they built a second ship, and they assumed the second voyage would be as successful, and it wasn't, as we talked about. But so Samuel, his brother, pilot, captained the second ship, it was called the Pilgrim, and Amasa Delano was the captain of the Perseverance. And, you know, it wasn't just this episode of putting down the slave. They were involved in other violent episodes that and brutal violence and just their voyages in different ways, and they come back to the Americas, and I think, you know, it's interesting, they come back to the Americas and they each take a different path in reaction to their failure. They're both failures in their own way, not just in terms of that voyage, but in general. And Samuel Delano becomes much more of a Christian and a true believer in Americanism as Christianity. He gives up the liberal Protestantism of his Duxbury youth, and he embraces a fire and brimstone vision of damnation and sin. He starts criticizing the liberal Christianity that is, you know, spreading throughout Duxbury and Boston and all throughout New England. He's an early voice of what becomes associated with the second great, with the Great Awakening. Amasa Delano goes in a different direction. He takes that liberal Christianity, which early on in the story gave him a more generous, tolerant view of other peoples. I mean, it had his limitations, obviously, for what he did at different moments. But he wasn't a supremacist. He didn't believe that white civilization stood at the apex of evolution. It was a premature. We associate that with the late 19th century Melville and people like that, who had a more generous understanding of other cultures. Delano had that earlier on. He comes back, and his failure prompts him into a much more cynical position vis-a-vis American power. He becomes very sarcastic and cynical about Christianity. He writes in a letter to his brother about abolishing Christianity, talks about the evils that Christians do. He talks in the last letter that he writes to his brother at the end of his life in 1823, he talks about not knowing his own mind. Here's somebody who came of age in a time which promised enlightenment and self-fulfillment and realization, and he dies saying he doesn't know his own mind or the minds of, and nobody can know their own minds. It's a very dark vision. In some ways, I take that as emblematic of two extreme poles of what happens when Americans go abroad. They get caught up in race terror and race violence, and then they come back. Not to draw too much from it, but in some ways they foreshadow, I think, the new right and the new left when they go to Vietnam. New right comes back from Vietnam and the horrors of Vietnam, and they much more committed to the American empire and the American project and fused to a right-wing version of Christianity. The new left, you know, some people come back politicized and activist, but others come back cynical and, you know, dissolute and not wanting to have anything to do with anything. And I think that you see in the experience of Amasa Delano and Samuel Delano a foreshadowing of that.
This book, The Empire of Necessity, allows us to begin to ask these critical questions and ponder about our nation's history as well as its present and future. We invite you to get a copy of this book by joining us, by becoming a member at 877-500-5266, or go to kboo.fm, and for a $60 pledge, you may get a copy of Greg Grandin's The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, Deception in the New World. And I'm going to go back to Sam and Wren.
Thank you, Cecil. That is correct. And my name is Sam, and you are listening to KBOO Community Radio's Winter Membership Drive, and right now is the time to call 877-500-5266 to support KBOO bringing you this kind of conversation where programmers are allowed to ask these critical questions. Yes. And I'm joined here by Ren, another volunteer with KBOO. We are so excited. We are so engaged on this topic and this interview, this conversation. And we are excited to be able to invite you to join in by with your financial support to keep these conversations going and to maintain a platform where these conversations happen, because no one is telling us not to. No one is we are not beholden to anyone that we're afraid might not like it, and so we better not do it, because we know we are beholden only to you, dear listener, and that's how we like it, and we know that's how you like it. That's what's kept KBOO going ever since June of 1968, and I dare say we'll still be around in June of 2060 with your help right now. 877-500-5266.
Yes, it's really, we keep saying call now. No, call now. Call now, because you support this program. Call now, because you are intellectually curious. Call now, because you are fascinated by the evolution of the duality of American consciousness, the left and right battle that we're still in. I mean, the story about the Delano brothers, 19th century sealers, how they walked away from the destruction of the sealing industry, one of them liberal, one of them right wing, it's Shakespearean even, and it actually happened. It's still relevant today. We still see these problems in resource extraction. We still see this in terms of social injustice. This is real. This is now. So call right now. Call now. 877-500-5266. A call right now says thank you to Greg for his appearance here. Thank you to him for bringing all these books. Thank you to him for writing this book. Thank you to Celeste and to Cecil for bringing him here. There's just gratitude all around right now. 877-500-5266.
And thank you to KBOO for making this bandwidth available to Cecil and Celeste to bring Greg Grandin and many other authors, thinkers, and scholars to you, dear listener. And that's where you close the circle by calling 877-500-5266. It all comes around. We are interdependent, dear listener. You rely on KBOO to bring you this information, to bring you these kinds of conversations, to raise these kinds of questions, and to get you and your friends and neighbors thinking about these kinds of issues that, as Ren pointed out, and as Mr. Grandin pointed out in conversation with Cecil and Celeste, that still resonate and are still relevant today. We hear about the use of racism as a tool of control, how Captain Delano used the putting down of the slave revolt to reassert his authority over his own crew. Where else do you hear this kind of a conversation other than KBOO? And where else can KBOO get the support it needs to continue to bring this to you, but from you directly? 877-500-5266. Call right now.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Ren. And we want to encourage people to read the book. The book is a sweeping recounting not only of the story of a man who had a vision of freedom that was unfortunately hooked and tied to capitalism, but it talks about other people's ideas of what freedom meant and how close capitalism followed on the heels of those dreams, either in terms of destroying it or supporting it. And the book gathers some important praise. As you know, I'm fond of a good literary effort, and one of my idols is Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison thinks that this is not only scholarship, but a penetrating and sweeping story and narrative. So,
Greg, we only have about 45 seconds. Thank you for coming. You'll be at Lewis and Clark this evening?
Yes, at 5 o'clock.
At 5 o'clock. One takeaway from your research that you discovered that might lead you onward, you know, in 30 seconds or less.
Well, the way the cult of individual supremacy that governs this country is rooted in the history of racism. I think that explains the racist rhetoric of the Tea Party. It's not whether they're racist or not. Their whole vision of political governance and political rights is rooted in exactly the kind of racism that Amasa Delano Melville was trying to get at in his portrayal of Amasa Delano.
Hey, thank you so much. You did that well. Thank you
for 45 seconds
for joining us.
But you'll tell a much richer story this evening if people come to hear you at Lewis and Clark. Again, we've been speaking with Greg Grandin. He is the author of the book, The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. Come hear him speak tonight at Lewis and Clark, 5 o'clock.
At 5 p.m. at the Council of Chambers or something like that?
Council Chambers. Bring
okay.
your robes.
Oh, yeah.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor a talk, Struggling to Win, Chilean Anarchists Building Popular Power. The talk by three Chilean anarchist organizers is on Wednesday, February 19th at 7 p.m. at PCC Cascade Campus in the Terrell Hall Building in room 122. Terrell Hall is located at North Jessup and Kirby Streets. This event is brought to you by the Institute for Anarchist Studies, the Hella 503 Collective, and Portland Central America Solidarity Committee, and is hosted by PCC's Q Club. That's Struggling to Win, Chilean Anarchists Building Popular Power, Wednesday, February 19th at PCC Cascades Terrell Hall, room 122. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. It is 9 o'clock, and up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part thanks to KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, hi, folks. We are moles in the ground. In some ways desecrated, in many places a ruined, toxified earth, but also hallowed ground, hallowed from centuries of struggle. The best things in this country, the Bill of Rights, the room here for fight back and struggle by the previously super subordinated of so many groups and colors and those that differ from some imagined norm. Also wonderful about this country, public education, and the remaining space for political dissent, to be sure, under attack. And one final great feature of where we live, this country, the music, the dance, the comics, fiction, so distinctly developed here, like jazz, the blues, country, and folk. The most notable achievements here in this country, they have arisen in democratic struggle and popular creativity from below, from a people seeking rich, fulfilling lives. Just for one example, we would not have a Bill of Rights had the common people not rejected the first offered Constitution. And this radio station, in its 45 years, it's contributed to that struggle in its programming, in its music and public affairs that honors the work of ordinary folks and their struggle, and critiques our increasingly top-down and polluting society, and promotes authentically democratic and sustainable lifeways. KBOO also contributes in its organization because it operates democratically, run by its members and committees, and through our democratically elected board. We prove that democracy works and better, including in media and all of production, at work and in personal life and family too. though of course differently in each sphere. This is day 12 of KABU's membership drive. If you listen to KABU and want to keep us on the air, please call, become a member. Show your appreciation and support for the programs that so enrich your life, that bring you the best in this country, and remind you that you are not alone, that there are so many people who love and support the values that you want to live by. We really want you to call and become a member. Join the KABU family. So today is President's Day, but this old mole show will not be celebrating any United States presidents. However, we will mention a few presidents. Mole Fran Michel will discuss the struggle in higher education to protect the schools, teachers, and students as the colleges go corporate, with college presidents, yes, presidents, earning in the seven figures, only a little less than many college football coaches in our going corporate educational system. Also today, we look at the film, Pete Seeger, The Power of Song, what that film does well and what it doesn't do. And we play an excerpt from Pete Seeger singing, "Dear Mr. President," that's president, as in President's Day. It's a peace song. First on today's Mole, I'm Bill Resnick, your host. Yesterday, I talked to Barbara Garson on the human costs of this long economic crisis. In fact, it's endured for working people for the last 40 years, just sort of peaked in 2008 and still continuing. And we also discussed the emerging fight back.
To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. To every...
Barbara Garson, welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
Barbara Garson got her first 15 minutes of fame in the mid-60s with the play McBird. In addition to several other plays, Garson is the author of four nonfiction books, All the Live Long Day, The Meaning of the Meaning of Routine Work at 1975, The Electronic Sweatshop in 88. Money Makes the World Go Round, One Investor Tracks Her Cash Through the Global Economy, 2001. And now this year, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Like her first three books, Down the Up Escalator describes a historical turning point through stories and the voices of a range of people who may or may not fully grasp the changes happening in their own lives. Barbara Garson, first tell us how you came upon and why you adopted that method to describe what you call going down the